The major question for business in a global economy is what's next? And it's a question that Greg Easterbrook confronts with careful optimism in his most recent book, Sonic Boom, A Guide to Surviving and Thriving in the New Global Economy. Mr. Easterbrook provides a guide for what to expect and how to cope with the chaotic and stressful yet prosperous future that he contends is coming. He believes that creativity and innovation must be allowed to grow and thrive because economic growth is produced by new ideas. And while he allows that growing prosperity will also result in growing anxiety, such a byproduct does not diminish his optimism about the economic boom he predicts is in our future. Easterbrook is a contributing editor of the Atlantic Monthly, the New Republic, and the Washington Monthly, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a distinguished fellow of the Fulbright Foundation. While Mr. Easterbrook's primary contributions focus on national politics and policy, he has also written, often with a rare sense of humor, on such diverse topics as weapon systems, sports, labor negotiations, poverty, electric power, and even the search for extraterrestrial life. He contributes the Tuesday Morning Quarterback column for ESPN.com. We are pleased to have him on campus and to hear from him today. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Greg Easterbrook to Brigham Young University.
Thank you. Good morning. Well, I just heard that you guys get to cut class to listen to me talk, so you'd better like me. In fact, I occasionally teach college seminars, and the first time I did it about 10 years ago, I said to my children, I have three, what if I'm no good at this? What if I'm a lousy teacher? And my oldest son, who was then about 12, looked at me and said, that's okay, Dad. They're students. They have to pretend that they like you. So please pretend that you like me, all right? Open with a joke, of course. This is a joke that's making the rounds in Washington, D.C., where I'm from. Barack Obama, former President Bill Clinton, and Sarah Palin all die at exactly the same instant. They die at exactly the same instant, maybe because they had lunch together at Cougar Eat. And because they die at exactly the same instant, they come before their maker to be judged at exactly the same instant. So the Lord is sitting resplendent on a throne. He's bathed in golden light. And he turns first to the president, and I'll try to do a God voice. I'm probably not very good at that. Probably none of us are. And says, Barack Obama, what do you believe? And Obama stands up and he clears his throat. He says, I believe in hope. And I believe in dreams, and I believe in change, and I believe in dreams of hope, and I believe in dreams for change. And the Lord says, all right, we get the point. Barack, you've lived a good life. Come sit by my side. And the Lord then turns to former President Clinton, and he says, Bill Clinton, what do you believe? And Clinton takes out, I don't know if you've ever heard Bill Clinton speak. He's a good speaker, but he's very long-winded. He takes out a huge sheaf of hundreds of sheets of paper. And he says, well, I just happen to have some remarks prepared. And he starts reading. And, you know, in heaven, it's kind of hard to judge the passage of time. A lot of time passes. People doze off. The cherubim, the baby angels, they fall asleep on their clouds. And at last, Clinton says, and in conclusion, and everybody wakes up. And the Lord kind of shakes himself and says, well, Bill, that was inspirational. You've lived a good life. Come sit by my side. And then the Lord turns to the former governor of Alaska and says, Sarah Palin, what do you believe? And Palin gives him a beady-eyed look and says, I believe you're sitting in my chair. That's a great joke because you can adjust the cast of characters to anybody you want to give the last line. It's a very versatile joke. All right. Now let's turn serious. On the plane out here to Salt Lake City, I was reading a book that was a pretty scary book. The book said the American experiment is in decline, that the United States will inevitably erode and fall apart, that technology is overwhelming us, that our educational system is not capable of dealing with changes in the world, the pace of change is overwhelming, resources are being exhausted, the country is doomed. It was a scary book, and that book was The Education of Henry Adams, written in the year 1907. People have been saying this about the American experiment. You can go back farther. You could go back to even to the 18th century and read prominent writers saying that America was a nation in decline and that modernity especially would overwhelm and swamp everything that we believed. Now, I can't promise you that that won't happen someday, but it's not happening now, and I don't think it will happen in your lifetimes. I think that the great forces of the globe are mainly good, although of course not exclusively. There are many problems, and there are many more problems coming. But most of what's happening in the world is positive. Most of what's happening in the world has been positive for decades. The college has asked me to talk in general about my two most recent nonfiction books, Progress Paradox and Sonic Boom. So let me first set the stage by telling you what Progress Paradox, published 9 years ago, said. I started working on Progress Paradox in the late 1990s, when the mood in Washington and in politics and in New York was, as always, fashionably gloomy. But when I looked around to the world, you know, I looked out my window and I saw a blue sky, I thought most things were getting better. So I wanted first to make an argument that most great forces of society were positive and had been positive for some time in both the United States and European Union and in most of the developing world. I then, in the course of this, came across the social science research that shows that rising prosperity does not necessarily make people any happier. So that became the progress paradox of the title of my book. Why is it that a better living standard doesn't make us happier? I'll get to that in a minute, but first let's talk about the great social forces that are these things were true 10 years ago, they're true today, and I think they will be true throughout your lifetime. We live in a time when disease is declining globally. People's odds of getting, not just in all the statistics I'll give you are for the entire world, not just for the privileged nations of the West. All forms of disease, almost all, are in decline. Lifespan is rising globally. It's rising everywhere in the world, even in the troubled places like Afghanistan. 100 years ago, average lifespan at birth was 46. At the dawn of the 21st century, it's 66. It's going to increase significantly during your lifetime everywhere. Freedom is expanding in most nations, not all, of course, but in most. Who would have believed even 25 years ago that the Soviet Union and Chinese communism would collapse? The power of liberal democracy is very strong and expanding throughout most of the world. Communication is getting easier and cheaper. You take it for granted that you can place a phone call from a miniature device to anywhere in the world at almost no cost. This historically is a great achievement. Education levels are rising throughout the world, especially for girls and women, which is most important in the developing world. All forms of pollution except for greenhouse gases have been in decline for a generation, including in the developing world, including in China. Now, greenhouse gases are a big exception. We can talk about that later. The science of climate change is getting stronger and stronger. But all other forms of pollution are in decline. And I think a century from now, children will say to their parents, "What was pollution?" And amazingly, people don't believe this. Oh, and of course, living standards are rising throughout the world. Per capita income is increasing broadly across the globe. Even if you eliminate the very wealthy countries of the Persian Gulf, per capita income is rising in the developing world. But here's the statistic that really knocks me out. Violence and war are in a 25-year cycle of decline globally. You wouldn't believe that from turning on your television, where we see the awful exception of the terrible images from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia. But in most of the world, violence and war are in decline. Your chance of dying by violence right now is the lowest that it's been in human history. Your chance of dying from malnutrition is also, United Nations figure. Your chance of dying from malnutrition right now is the lowest that it's ever been in human history, even though the global population has doubled in 40 years. Sometime next month, the United Nations will announce that the global population has hit 6 billion people. seven from 6 to 7. In 1970, there were 3 billion souls in the world. Now there are 7. And they're less likely to be malnourished. They're less likely to be victims of violence. They are more likely to be free. They are more likely to be educated. They're less likely to be sick. All these things are happening all around you. There's a fabulous book that hasn't been published. It comes out in 2 weeks, called Winning the War Against War. It's by a professor at American University named Josh Goldstein, who's a friend of mine. And it's about the social forces that have caused war and violence to decline. Now, there's no guarantee something horrible won't go wrong. I mean, the war has been in decline for only 20 years. That is historically a short time. But during the period that most of you in this room have been alive, human beings have fought each other less and less. And that trend continues. It's a trend that makes the world a good and a promising place to go out into as you graduate. Now, all the things we just said, you would never know from listening to or watching the national media. Years ago, I gave a talk called Why the Good News Scares People. And especially from the media standpoint, good news is scary. We're conditioned to think that bad things are about to happen. We're probably conditioned by evolution to assume the worst about the world. We're certainly conditioned by the news media to assume the worst about the world. The news media strongly emphasize negative news. This is not without a certain amount of logic. Scandals, crises, these things are things that you all urgently need to know. But the news media don't tell you the good side as well. My big complaint against the news media is not that they report scandals. Of course you have to report scandals. But they don't report progress, good news, rising living standards, especially in the developing world. Many of you, because of the nature of BYU, will eventually go overseas to live in developing countries. When you see developing world news in the American media, you see explosions, fires, rioting, and anger. I hope you will go to one of the many places of the world where you will not experience that, where you will experience instead gradually rising human progress, and especially in politics. Media, our politics are very vindictive now, very partisan, and the news media tend to bring that out in the political system. An easy example of the love of bad news is this. You know that in the last year, the stock market has become very turbulent. It's too turbulent. It's up 5% one day, down 5% the next. Obviously, the underlying value of the economy does not change anywhere near that quickly. But I've been watching for the last year, and I've been keeping a log. Whenever the stock market drops by 3 or 4%, it's always headline news the following day in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. The headline is always, stock market collapses on Greek fears, or whatever the fear was that day. Whenever the stock market rises by a similar amount, the newspapers don't mention it. It's just a simple example of the preference for bad news over good. Intellectuals certainly love bad news. Students, I'll give you two books, actually one magazine article and one book to look up if you want a great subject to write about in any kind of comparative journalism or public policy class. My magazine that I've written for most of my life, The Atlantic Monthly, which is the greatest, I think, the best intellectual publication in the United States. It's wonderful. It's wise. I hope you've all read it. We've had some strikeouts and whiffs. If you go back and look to 1994, Atlantic Monthly had a cover story whose title was The Coming Anarchy. Sounds pretty scary, doesn't it? The thesis of the article by a guy named Bob Kaplan, who's a nice man who I personally like, was that the world was about to collapse into a Hobbesian anarchy, a war of all against all, that social order was about to break down. This article, 1994, again, was the publication date, predicts that the United States would collapse as a country by the year 2010, which seems to have passed. The United States would collapse, that the European Union would collapse, that hundreds of millions of people would die in the developing world of starvation or Hobbesian combat. Basically, the world was going to hell in a handbasket very rapidly. Intellectuals loved this cover. Bob Kaplan got invited to the White House to meet Bill Clinton. The article was wisely praised. Go back and read it. Everything in it turned out to be wrong. And yet, if he had written a cover story whose headline was, instead of The Coming Anarchy, The Coming Gradual Improvement of Most Barometers of Well-Being, you know how that one would have sold, right? Since the movie Contagion is in theaters right now, its technical advisor is a woman named Lori Garrett, who's a fellow of the August Council on Foreign Relations, which is the very summit of the American foreign policy establishment. Go back and read her 1995 book that made her well-known, titled The Coming Plague. That book predicts that an unstoppable super plague will kill 500 million people across the world by the year 2010. Nothing that that book predicts has turned out to be true, but the establishment loved that book because it boiled down to we're all going to die, and that was a popular point of view. Well, of course, we are all going to die, but that's a separate matter. Now, let me talk a little bit more about progress paradox, and then I'll go on to sonic boom. So first half of that book was arguing that most things, of course not everything, but that most things were getting better for most people in most nations. But why don't we feel any better about it? The psychological data shows that we are people of the current generation are less likely to be happy than their parents and grandfathers were, despite rising living standards. Well, some of the conclusions here are common sense. Your grandmother was right. Money cannot buy happiness. We all say that we believe that, but how many people live as if they believe that? Everyone needs food, clothing, and shelter. You do not need a Mercedes. You don't need a fancy house. But how many people behave as if they need those things? The things that really matter in life can't be purchased on the free market. The things that matter are love, respect, honor, a sense of purpose, a sense of worth in the community. You can't buy those things with money. There are a lot of billionaires who have spent a lot of money trying to buy respect and have been unsuccessful. So the core reason that rising living standards doesn't make us any happier is that the things that we really want in life cannot be purchased with money. Another reason is that stress that you feel is real. Stress evolved. The stress response this isn't a biology class, but the stress response in a mammal body is mediated by a hormone called cortisol. And when researchers test for it, our bodies contain more of it than the bodies of previous generations. So it's not in your mind that you feel stress. You do feel stress. Society is getting more stressful all the time. We are constantly surrounded by the kind of stimuli, loud noises, big cars, etc., that evolution many generations ago conditioned us to respond to only occasionally, and now we have those stress-inducing stimuli around us all the time. So if you think, why do I feel stressed out? You live in a world that feels stressed out. And I think that's probably going to get worse. I'll make two more points about that book. One is, if you're taking any psychology classes, I hope your teachers are mentioning to you the positive psychology movement that began at the University of Pennsylvania about 20 years ago and has since spread to a lot of academic departments of psychology. The old goal of psychology, especially from its founding in the 19th century, was to determine the causes of neuroses. Why do people become mentally ill? The new goal of psychology, at least a positive psychologist, is to determine why do people become sane? What causes sanity? Why are some people altruistic? Why are some people outgoing and self-sacrificing? Why do people acquire admirable virtues? I mean, if social forces make you crazy, what forces make you sane? And the positive psychology movement has done a lot of great work in that regard. And the fast version of their big finding is studying people who have a positive sense of well-being, people who have a negative sense of well-being. The big bright line between the two groups is whether they believe their lives have meaning. Now, the LDS Church won't like what I'll say next. You do not have to, in social science research, you do not have to derive the sense of meaning from religious philosophy. Certainly you can. You can find meaning in revelation. You don't have to. You can be an atheist and believe that your life has purpose. But the core thing is you've got to believe your life has purpose. Life has meaning. You're here for a reason. These thoughts lead to sanity and to mental health. The opposite set of thoughts lead to neuroses. So the positive psychology movement, look it up. Very fascinating stuff. I'll close on the first book, Progress Paradox, by giving you my main conclusions from it. My main conclusion is that there are selfish reasons to become a better person. I love that line. I'm tempted to write a self-help book just so that I could use the title Selfish Reasons to Become a Better Person. Your grandmother, when you go to church, you're lectured, be grateful, optimistic, and forgiving, because these things are seen as altruistic character traits. Obviously, people who are grateful, optimistic, and forgiving, we admire people like that. But we think that they're doing it because, you know, this is what God would want us to feel. God wants us to forgive others, to be grateful, to be optimistic. This is the altruistic way to live life. That's the best way to live life for yourself. A selfish person should be grateful, optimistic, and forgiving because you make the world a better world around you. The argument for forgiveness is that if you maintain anger and bitterness in your heart, even if you've been wronged, and everybody gets wronged at some point, if you stay bitter in your heart, who's the victim? You're the victim of that. If you forgive, you're set free. If you feel optimistic, that doesn't mean that everything's going to go right. Terrible things can happen to optimistic people. But it does increase your chances of a successful life. And if you feel gratitude, if you think of, well, just here in this beautiful valley in Utah, if you think of what your ancestors 150 years ago went through to make it possible for you to live in relative luxury here in Utah, or you could name a million other places in the world, and you don't feel grateful for that, who's being cheated? You're the one who's being cheated. The sense of gratitude should enrich your life. So there are selfish reasons to become a better person, and the three things you want to concentrate on, in my view, and this is also the social science research of positive psychology backs this up, is forgiveness, gratitude, and optimism. These are all learned conditions. We're not born optimistic. We're not born forgiving. If you learn to be these things, your own experience of life will improve. And if you make the world a better place, isn't that nice? Now, let me move on to the current book, Sonic Boom. I was finishing this book in 08, just as the big recession was beginning. Obviously, you're all very keenly aware that we're in a recession at the moment. Technically, we're not anymore. Technically, the recession ended last year. But still, growth is not what we want, and unemployment statistics, obviously, are scary. The lesson of history, if you look back to various crises of the past, is that when the crisis ends, the larger trends resume. And what were the larger trends before the crises of 08 began? Rising living standards, very rapid economic growth in the developing world, mildly rapid economic growth here, increasing freedom, ease of communication, declining disease, declining pollution, declining war. All the trends before 08 were positive, or almost all. And I think once the financial meltdown of 08 shakes itself out, and it hasn't happened yet, but it will happen soon, that the positive trends that were holding sway before will resume. Now, let me think. Brent mentioned the phrase, what's next? Let me give you some suggestions about what I think is next. First, on globalization. Globalization may be driving you crazy. It's certainly driving me crazy. Everybody over the age of 40 is driven crazy by globalization. I think globalization is just getting started. I think we are in the initial phase. If you don't like it now, you're going to like it a lot less worse, because the world is going to get much more global. But globalization is mainly good for us. It certainly causes economic prosperity. The United States economic growth has been stagnant now this is entering the fourth year. But the majority of the human family does not live in the United States. Most men and women in the world live in the developing world, and their economic growth has been good. Globalization has been a boon for the developing world. It's made living standards much better for the majority of the human population. Maybe not for all of us. You know, if you work in a factory in Indiana, globalization, you know, there's no way around it. It's been bad for you. But for most members of the human family, globalization has been great. And I think it's just beginning. It's going to accelerate. We're going to be much more interconnected in the future than we are today. And by the future, I mean during your lifetimes. The next thing to be aware of is that network effects are just getting started. That amazing iPhone that's in your pocket, you think that's the summit of network technology? That's the ground floor of network technology. That even though your iPhone, the CIA had nothing like that 20 years ago, your own children will consider that thing so primitive They'll look at it like we look at crank-operated phonographs today. Network effects are just getting started. Most technology is the accumulation of small tinkering changes rather than great breakthroughs. Electronic technology is really just starting to accelerate. And there are some spooky things you can think about electronic technology. There are things that could go wrong, including artificial life, which is a very, very spooky thought. But in the main, technology and network effects are going to accelerate greatly during your lifetime, and for prosperity at least, this is going to be good for us. The world's supply of ideas is in the process of skyrocketing. And what's more important, ideas or petroleum? If you could have one or the other, if you could have the content of an oil deposit or all of the ideas at Google, which one would you rather have? I think I know how you would answer that question. And while the amount of petroleum in the world is not going to change a heck of a lot, the global content of ideas is skyrocketing, not so much in the United States and European Union, where we've always been pretty good at ideas, but in the developing world. The developing world has only recently become a source of ideas, engineering ideas, philosophical ideas, political ideas. Most of the human family lives in the developing world. As the developing world develops and becomes free and begins to communicate, its production of ideas will skyrocket. The other big thing that's happening is that almost half of the human family, women, living in the developing world and even in the United States and Western Europe until a couple of generations ago, contributed very little to the global store of ideas. Now that's going to change. Women are just as good at creating ideas as men are. As women acquire political and economic freedom in the developing world, business ideas, engineering, science, medical ideas from women are going to rapidly accelerate human progress. Women may leave men in the dust as a source of ideas a generation from now, and that's going to happen in your lifetime as well. All these are reasons why global indicators are positive, especially outside the Western world. I'll read you one statistic that I got to read to make sure I got it correct, but that seems spectacular to me. 30 years ago, according to the United Nations, 2.5 billion people lived at the level of medium development, which is, you know, roughly middle class. Now, 4.2 billion people live at the level of medium development. That's almost 2 billion people living in good physical circumstances added to the human family in just 30 years, and that's almost all of the additions to the human family in the last 30 years have joined at the level of medium development. This is spectacular. When historians look back on our period, the two things that they will remark on most, it's not going to be Taylor Swift, I'm sorry I got to break this to you, but the things that historians will care about most is rising prosperity in the developing world because of the number of people involved, and the decline of the number of nuclear weapons on Earth. Nuclear weapons are in very dramatic decline. We hardly ever talk about either thing. These are the movements that have historic significance. And the spread of freedom, I guess that would be the third one of historic significance. Those things are going on all around us, and we almost never talk about them. We also, of course, it's also human nature not to really think about what didn't happen as opposed to what did. So let's think about what didn't happen in the last few decades. There was never a superpower confrontation. 25 years ago, the United States and Soviet Union each had 30,000 strategic nuclear warheads. They were never used. Now each side has about 3,000, and the number is still going down. Inflation hasn't happened anywhere in the world in 30 years. You think unemployment's bad, where do you see inflation? 1970s unemployment was 10.2 and inflation was 15% a year. The lot of the average person got worse fast. Now we've had 30 straight years without inflation. Maybe it'll come back, but it's something that didn't happen, so we don't think about it. Crop failures haven't happened. When's the last time you heard the word crop failure used? The last time the word crop failure has been used in global politics was 1979, when the old Soviet Union had a wheat crop failure. We haven't used that word since. 33 straight years without a major crop failure anywhere in the world. If there were major crop failures and food were in short supply, I promise you, this would rapidly swamp all other issues combined. But it hasn't happened. And there's never been a superpower relationship like the United States and China. China's a crazy place. You got to go there to believe it. It's the craziest place in the world. It's also on its way to joining the United States in power and stature. And we're mainly cooperating with each other instead of mainly trying to destroy each other. And yeah, there's all kinds of nutty problems with China. It's not fully free, etc. But our relationship is mainly cooperative. When in the history of the world have the two greatest superpowers mainly cooperated with each other? That's a wonderful change happening during your generation. All these trends are positive. They should continue. Stress is a trend. It's going to continue too. Stress, anxiety, the feeling of global turbulence, it's going to get worse. One reason is that communication makes us easier and faster for us to know what's going on in the world. And therefore, we know what's going wrong in the world. If you lived in Provo, Utah 100 years ago, things that happened in the countries we now call Pakistan or Malaysia would have been abstractions to you, and there's no chance they ever could have had any effect on your life. Now if something explodes in Pakistan, you know about it 30 seconds later, and it feels personally threatening to you. So those forces will make us more anxious and more stressed out in the future. And there's a great larger source of stress, and that's that nobody's in charge of the global economy. It's the single most important thing going on Earth is the global economy, and nobody runs it. You think the president runs it? No. You think the chairman of the Federal Reserve runs it? Or maybe somebody really powerful like the CEO of Walmart is running the global economy. No one is running the global economy. That may even be a source of its success, but it's a source of the stress we feel. And though I'm mainly an optimist, I'm not a Pollyanna, the stress you feel and the anxiety you feel is going to get worse. You're going to live a very stressed out generation. You should prepare for it. Now, let me close with two thoughts, and then I'll take questions. One is this. As a mainly optimistic person, the thing that I can't stand hearing, especially from kids, but I hear it from my generation too, is that it's too late to change the world. It's never too late to change the world. You hear, you go to academia especially, you hear, well, if we'd done this or that in the 60s, or well, if the older George Bush had done this or that. I'm not interested in that line of thought. It is never too late to change the world. Whatever you want to accomplish can still be done. Changing the world is hard. Most people who try fail. But everybody can contribute to the improvement of the world. It's never too late. No matter what's going on that you don't like, it's too late. It is not too late to change it. Throw yourself into it with enthusiasm, and you'll be surprised at what you can accomplish. My final point is this. What's the big challenge for your generation, besides operating technical devices? When I look at my father's generation, my father grew up in poverty during the Depression in a small farming town in Ontario. His generation conquered the Depression and they defeated the Nazis. My generation, I'm a baby boomer, maybe we can take credit for the civil rights movement. I guess that's our big achievement. What's your big challenge going to be? Your big challenge is the success of the developing world. The United States has mainly been built. It needs reform. It needs improvement. But most of what needed to have been accomplished in the United States has been accomplished. The developing world is 4 billion people who need to be lifted up and are doing a pretty good job on their own without our help, but with our help could do even better. I think that is the great challenge for your generation. If you can help bring the developing world, play any small role in bringing it to physical prosperity, personal freedom, and democracy, that's what your generation is going to be called on to accomplish. And of the great accomplishments that I just mentioned, Depression, Nazis, civil rights, the one facing you is the most important. And I think your lives will be defined by it. That challenge lies mainly outside the United States. And I know you as an audience are more keenly aware of this than most college audiences would be. But I mentioned to you it to you specifically, because I think most of the challenge of your lifetime is going to lie outside our country. And the potential for success is very high. But, of course, I'm an optimist, so naturally I would think that. So those are my comments. Thank you.